We will get started in 2 minutes. I'm just trying to.
Okay. It's done.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Okay. We are just going to start now. And I just want to. Okay. Hello, Artur. Perfect. Okay. So I'll just review again. If you are looking for English, French, or Spanish, if you tap on the very bottom of your laptop screen, there will be a little world. Tap on there and you can choose English, French, or Spanish, and the whole meeting will be in that language for you. And so it will be so much easier. We have a lot of people here. If you are interested in making a question or comment, you can use the chat function or you can post your questions or comments, or you can raise your hand rather. And we will just start shortly. Emily, we have a lot of people in the waiting room again. Very happy to have Emily with us to do support. It's wonderful to have these technologies, but sometimes it's a bit like herding cats to get everything organized.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm from Indonesia. My name is Sihar.
Thank you, Sihar.
I just want to check with the, you know, on my video. Is it working?
You're not on video now. You were on video earlier.
I'm not. Okay. All right. Okay. Here you go. Thank you.
Shaki, you've raised your hand. You need to unmute. Shaki?
Yeah. Okay. I have a problem. I did send all my details with my country. I'm from Yemen, from the Yemeni parliament. But the only thing I can see is my name only without the country name, Yemen, like all the others.
Yeah, that's because you on your computer, it's set up that way. So I'll just add your country for you. It's no problem.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
That's it so far.
Okay.
Excellent.
Thank you. I'm going to just lower your hand now.
Yes. Can you also Ali's add my country name? Senator Musharraf Hussain from Pakistan. So
okay.
My name is coming without my country name.
When Zoshti Aziza.
Okay, just a second.
Zoshti when.
Okay. Sorry. Sorry, you're from Pakistan.
Yeah.
And it's Ali what?
Senator Musharraf Hussain. So it's Pakistan should be there in the front. The country name is missing.
I know that. I can see that. But you don't have, all it says is Ali's iPad.
Yeah, this is me.
I know, but what's your
name? That's it. No. Patty, those are two different people. I think you might not just be able to see them on your screen. So Ali has raised his hand.
Yes.
Yes, Ali. Yeah. Ali's pad is me. My name is Ali Bazzi. I'm a member of parliament in the state of Lebanon.
Oh.
Emily.
Yes, Alessandro.
Is there a chance you can help with these people when we start the meeting and afterwards?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We are already 8 minutes late.
Yeah. I'm from Pakistan, Senator Musharraf Hussain.
Okay,
Senator, sir? I'll take care of your renaming.
Okay. All right.
We're 8 minutes late.
I know.
Yo soy la senadora Beatriz Paredes de Mexico.
Okay. My name is Senator Beatriz Paredes from Mexico.
Okay, everybody, if I can just get your attention now, please. We are going to start, and I am going to start the recording. So we will be posting the recording on our website. So we are going to start now, okay?
Thank you.
Recording in progress.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Patty Torsney, and I'm the permanent observer for the IPU to the United Nations. We are going to have this two-hour meeting on the occasion of the high-level political forum. I do need everyone to be on mute, please, if I can have you mute yourself.
Buen día, Diego.
Emily, if you can help me get everyone muted, that would be great. We do have a jam-packed agenda, and I am hoping that we can get many questions and comments from members of Parliament in the two sessions. In the first session, the entire meeting is, of course, entitled Message from the Pandemic, Bring Government Back. And we wondered, on the occasion of this high-level political forum, if the implicit message of the COVID-19 pandemic, that government, the public authority consisting of the executive, parliament, the judiciary, and the public administration, must play a more proactive role in the economy and in society. And to kick off our comments today, we have the IFPU president, Duarte Pacheco, joining us from Portugal. And I will turn to Mr. Pacheco for his remarks. And then we will turn to our panel, which I will introduce at that time. Over to you, President.
Good afternoon. Good morning to you, Patty. It is a pleasure to be with you, dear colleagues, in this high-level political forum on sustainable development, in this annual parliamentarian forum, my first one as president of IPU. As you see, again, a virtual forum. This pandemic will not allow us to meet so soon, and so in person. So we keep working, and here we are, working because democracy and the parliaments didn't close our doors, but we should do as it is possible, virtually. Dear colleagues, welcome and thank you so much for attending this meeting, and I wish you all a good journey of work. I need to say something that for me is very interesting. The essential item of the forum, is, of this parliamentarian forum, is the bring government back. Yes, it is a reality that the pandemic showed the importance of the presence of the government and so of parliaments and the public authorities in our economy. Since the 80s, in many countries, we saw that the main headlines of the presence of an economy is about the invisible hand. That the market will work and the government should keep one step back. But after the beginning of the pandemic, many people, also those that usually are against intervention of government, ran and try to help, to ask for help from the governments, to help not just to fight the pandemic, but also help to the recovery of the economy and to avoid the social effects of the crisis. And so we have a new paradigm now. We should discuss it, and we should discuss and try to get some lessons from it. First of all, the importance of investments in many areas, like health policy. In the beginning of the pandemic, we saw that not just in poor countries, but also in rich countries, the investments are too small. And the crisis of the pandemic shows that the health systems are not available to respond to all people that need it, need help from them. Also in Europe or in other rich countries of the world. So it shows that the resources, for instance, to the health sector, to the health policy, to investment in research are essential. And as you know, dear colleagues, the budget in all democratic countries are approved all inside our parliaments. So we have a role, a special role on it. But after it, we saw the consequences of the pandemic, the increasing of poverty, the increasing of unemployment, that many sectors are suffering, not just tourism or culture or sports, but also small business that closed doors and put a lot of people, millions, on unemployment. The gap between rich and poor increased. And so, what we may do? Try to see for the future that the recovery will come just by the market, or is important to have intervention from the public sector, from the government. In many countries, in US, in European Union, in India, in China, in countries of Latin America, or in Asia, or in Africa, we saw that the governments create programs to help families to keep their earnings, but also to keep, to help economy to resist to the crisis, to avoid more and more unemployment. And so it shows that a new paradigm is in our hands, and we should discuss if we wish to come back to the old one, or if we take some lessons and we will improve a special role to the government in future. And this is important, yes, because sustainable development goals are the meta, are the target, are the objective in the middle term. And to achieve it, to achieve the target we wish, we should try to do it not with the old paradigm, but with the new one. Of course, we are not talking about the came back to a planification of the economy. Of course not. But we may understand that economy, where the governments don't have a special role in public investment, in keeping a social equilibrium in our societies, economy or a society that will not invest public, that don't have public investments in research, the recovery will be more longer, and maybe the targets that we wish to achieve on sustainable development goals will be not so soon as we wish, as it was forecast in the beginning. So this is a moment to parliamentarians, to politicians, talk about it. Without dogmas, without questions made, and without answers pre-made. We should discuss open, because we should learn from this crisis. we should learn from a society that shows that a small virus can affect all of us in all continents, all the economies, all societies. It shows also that we politicians should try to understand that multilateralism is essential and work together to find solutions is something essential. This is why we will discuss in this forum, in this parliamentarian meeting, to understand what is our role, how we should support our governments, how we should incentive our governments to act in the next future, to win the war against the virus, but also to win the other pandemic, not on health, but in the economy and in society. And I believe that if we are open to understand what the others are doing well, to understand the best practices from one country or other country, we will do our work better and better. This is something that is important for all of us. So, dear colleagues, I wish you a very productive meeting with a lot of intervention, with a lot of discussion, because we should always have open minds to understand that it's possible to improve our knowledge, and this way we will force our governments to come back to society and to help the recovery of our economies. Thank you so much, and I wish you a very productive journey. Thank you, Patty. Thank you, dear colleagues.
Thank you so much, President. Those are great messages to kick off this the beginning of this meeting. We will now have a panel. We have three people on the panel. We will first hear from the UN Special Rapporteur. We'll hear from Pedro Arroja Aguda. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights to Safe Drinking Water and Sanitation. In addition to being a renowned professor, he's also a former parliamentarian from Spain. And so we're very pleased to have you in that capacity and understanding as well. We'll also hear from Ms. Isabel Ortiz, who's the Director, Global Social Justice Program at Columbia University. And she, of course, has a great career as well, having been with the International Labor Organization for many years. And from Mexico, we will have Senator Nancy de la Serra, who's the president of the Sustainable Development Committee. And I will say a little bit more about each of them, perhaps. But first, I will go to you, Professor Pedro Arroja Aguda.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members of parliaments around the world, thank you for the honor of this invitation and for your attention. I would have preferred to speak in Spanish, but I thought I should speak in English, and I apologize to Spanish speakers. This misunderstanding was my responsibility. In any case, no problem. Well, discúlpenme, amigos hispanoparlantes.
My apologies to the Spanish speakers. I thought that I had to speak in English, but well.
Humanity is facing, among others, a crisis that is as tragic as it is paradoxical. The global water crisis on the water planet, the blue planet, with 2.2 billion people without guaranteed access to safe drinking water. In terms of diagnosis, and with the exception of population in semi-arid and arid regions severely affected by climate change that deserve urgent international attention. Strictly speaking, the vast majority of these 2.2 billion people are not properly thirsty people without water in their living environment, but impoverished people living next to rivers, lakes, and aquifers polluted. In short, the roots of this global water crisis, in my view, lie at the confluence of two major critical failures. The failure of unsustainability caused in our aquatic ecosystems, transforming water, the key factor of life, into the most terrible vector of disease and death ever known. And on the other hand, the failure of inequity and poverty under deeply immoral socioeconomic systems. From the neoliberal vision, instead of considering water as a public good, it is considered as a simple economic resource, useful and scarce, to be managed according to the logic of the market, and thus promoting a mercantilist and a privatizing approach. But in doing so, it transforms people into mere customers, and those 2.2 billion people into poor customers with serious difficulties in paying. Therefore, this approach, far from solving the global water crisis, aggravates it by making the most vulnerable even more vulnerable. The management of water, even as a financial asset, by promoting its entry into the Wall Street future markets under the speculative logic that dominates these markets. I'm deeply concerned about it. That is why my first thematic report to the UN General Assembly next 20 October in New York focuses on this. And I invite you to follow up on that report. But excellencies, let me ask your attention in advance on this issue by recalling what happened in 2008 with food managed under the speculative logic prevailing in these future markets. In those years, following a profound deregulation of financial markets that allowed large banks to enter the food future markets, just when many of these large corporations had raised huge public funds to avoid bank failures due to the real estate bubble they themselves had caused, hundreds of billions of dollars were invested in food commodity futures, causing the prices of wheat, corn, or rice to double and even triple in what was a new speculative bubble. According to the World Bank, the number of hungry people in the world increased by a further 150 million people. With regard to climate change, there is general consensus on the need for energy transition. However, the main socioeconomic impacts of climate change are generated around the water vector, which should lead adaptation strategies to be dominated by hydrological transition. So, excellencies, I ask that we work together to raise the level of attention on adaptation strategies to be promoted based on the water transition. Finally, on the challenge of accelerating efforts on water and sanitation services to achieve SDG 6 in the face of the climate change, let me reflect on the lessons we are learning from the pandemic. Years ago, in the 2008 crisis, the argument of the so-called financial gap due to the lack of public funds to finance the needs of wash services made sense in the context of austerity strategies and served, in fact, to justify private investments and public-private strategies. And in saying this, I'm in no way trying to justify this approach, the mistake of these austerity strategies and their catastrophic consequence of poverty and inequality. But today, it doesn't make sense. Fortunately, the pandemic has forced a change in approach. Indeed, trillions of dollars have been, are being, and will be made available to address the pandemic and the post-pandemic socioeconomic revival in the context of the Green New Deal challenge of the 21st century. On the other hand, As a result of the ordeal of the pandemic, a general consensus is growing on the need to strengthen public health systems as an unprecedented non-for-profit, leave-no-one-behind public effort. Public investments in WASH services as a cornerstone of public health must, in my view, be addressed as a matter of priorities, as a global democratic imperative, especially in impoverished countries and communities. The challenge is to ensure not only the development of these services, but also their affordability for the 2.2 billion impoverished people who will not be able to pay if the financializing logic that has predominated the economy, has dominated the economy, is applied. We are talking about a democratic challenge, not a business opportunity. The surprisingly hasty debate on global taxation sparked by President Biden is, in my view, a signal that the time has come for a new fiscal approach to better redistribute health and strengthen public capacities to meet the challenges of what is shaping up to be epochal change. And in particular, I believe that the pandemic is giving us an opportunity to rethink the close link between public health and the human rights to safe drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene. But this time, with arguments reinforced by unprecedented social support generated by the suffering caused by the pandemic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Special Rapporteur Pedro Arrojo Agudo. And thank you for that impassioned speech in English. And I'm sorry for the mix-up. I will now turn to Isabel Ortiz, who, as I mentioned, is the Director of Global Social Justice Program at Columbia in the Joseph Stiglitz Initiative for Policy Dialogue. I mentioned she was the Director of Social Protection Department at the ILO, and she was also an Associate Director of Policy and Strategy at UNICEF in New York. So she has a considerable background to bring to this discussion as well. And I will remind everybody that this main segment of the Parliamentary Forum revolves around the question, how can parliaments help redefine the relationship between the government-led public sector and the market-led private sector? Is rebalancing needed? And should parliament support more expansive fiscal policies to respond to growing demands for education, healthcare, and other public goods? What steps can parliaments take to curb financialization and reduce the dominance of large monopolies in all sectors of the economy? And lastly, what institutional reforms should parliaments promote to make government more resilient and better able to respond to the needs of the people? And without further ado, I will turn to Ms. Ortiz.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in this very interesting debate today. The COVID-19 pandemic has evidenced the weak state of public health systems. Generally, they were overburdened, underfunded, and understaffed after decades of insufficient investments. This is because since the 1980s, a neoliberal policy approach was to minimize the role of the state, cutting public expenditures, deregulating standards, and liberalizing, commercializing, or privatizing public services. This outdated approach is the cause of a large increase in inequalities worldwide, as the United Nations, Piketty, and others show, and it's very relevant to this HLPF, as we are looking at SDG 10 and inequality. But what is less known is that this approach, this neoliberal approach, was not working, and many governments are starting reversing course in a number of policies, such as public services. In recent years, a number of governments that privatized public services are reversing the privatization and renationalizing public services, due, among others, to poor performance, reduced services, higher user fees leading to affordability issues, regulatory capture, and declines in investments. And let me give you some examples. Water supplies, in water supply, in the last 15 years, 235 cases of water remunicipalization, that was the term used to say a reversal of privatization and making the services public, has happened in 235 cases, concentrated mostly in high-income countries, in 184 cities remunicipalized in higher-income economies, for instance, in France, in the United States, Spain, or Germany. And perhaps the most known case was Paris in 2000, the remunicipalization of Paris water supply in 2010 that led to improved delivery and reduced water prices. The same in transport. A number of countries saw that privatization had dramatically reduced services and prices increased sharply. And it has led to renationalization of transport in different sectors, subsectors, like in Japan, New Zealand, Argentina, United Kingdom, and Pakistan in different recent years. In pensions, what is less known is actually, despite pressures to privatize, only 30 countries of the world really privatized pensions. And of these 30 countries, only 18 reversed the privatization of pensions fully and partially. Such as Argentina, Bolivia, Hungary, Poland, and Kazakhstan. And there are other, these reversals of privatization has happened in recent years in other sectors, like, such as postal services, communications, electricity, or security services. So these are a very important trend to realize prior to the pandemic. But now we are a moment overcoming the pandemic. So what happens now? Now the moment is a kind of crossroads, and we have seen governments going kind of both ways. On the one hand, governments have seen that they have become more powerful, that they had to invest more on health services, social protection, and support of enterprises and economic activity to navigate the pandemic. And they very much right see that they need to continue this public support. On the other hand, if we look at the fiscal analysis done by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, we see that austerity cuts are expected in nothing less than 159 countries starting mid this year. And we launched a global austerity alert because of that. You can download it and check your own country. Now, the good news is that this is based on the fiscal projections contained on the IMF World Economic Outlook, their public information, and it does not need to be true. These are just fiscal projections done by IMF economists, and they think that this is what is going to happen. And as mentioned, as of middle of this year, 154 countries will start contracting public expenditures, and as many as 159 countries we start with austerity cuts in 2021. That means the majority of world countries, there are 192 countries, okay? So that means that 85% of the world population, more than 6.6 billion people, will be affected by austerity cuts next year. The very important news is that this does not need to happen. Again, there are alternative options, okay? But we need to be vigilant to a number of traditional cuts that are happening. And typically, these are wage bill cuts or caps. That means cuts in the number of the salaries of civil servants. That means teachers, health officials, civil servants at the local level that actually have a very important function, you know, for the welfare of societies. Then it's also a very important reform is there are social security and pension reforms. These are expected in a large number of countries. And when I was director at the International Labour Organization, actually seeing the number of reforms, we could project that pensioners are going to receive much lower pensions in the future as a result of these reforms. Typical other reforms include narrow targeting of welfare and simply, you know, doing safety nets for the very poorest. Of course, the poor need to be protected, but welfare needs to be for everybody, as agreed in the Sustainable Development Goals. Other reforms include labor flexibilization reforms, and accompanying that, normally VAT increases and privatizations. These are
the standard reforms generally suggested by international financial institutions. Now, what is very clear is that these fiscal decisions are very important for the life of people, and they cannot be taken behind closed doors by a few technocrats in the Ministry of Finance. These decisions affect the life of millions of people in the country, and they need to be part of public dialogue, including all major stakeholders and parliaments, and they need this public dialogue. They need to be open, cannot be behind closed doors. And the very good news is that there are alternatives. Actually, there are 8 options, financing options, that all governments can take, and even in the poorest countries. And these 8 of the financing options are fully promoted by the United Nations and by the international financial organizations. And countries have been taking them. Yes.
Excuse me. Can I get you to adjust your microphone just as you're coming to the 8 important interventions? There is a bit of a static on the line. I don't know if you can just move it up slightly.
I can, but I hope. Okay, that's I'll try to raise the voice. Very sorry about that. So there are 8 financing options that are available to most countries, even the poorest countries. And these 8 options are fully endorsed by statements, policy statements of the United Nations and the international financial organizations. And countries have been adopting them for decades. So it means that actually they're known to governments. And however, they're not so known to the public. And it's very important that parliamentarians become aware of that too, because they need to be discussed in this national dialogue and not just being taken, you know, behind closed doors. So these 8 options, if you're interested, if I have time, I enumerate them, and otherwise we leave it for the discussion. So these 8 options are, first of all, increase progressive taxation. That not means any type of taxation. Countries very often are increasing only consumption taxes or VAT. This is regressive because it means that poor people pay the same as wealthy people. It's important to move towards more progressive taxation that taxes income or wealth of individuals or corporations, including the financial sector that does not pay taxes in the majority of countries. And there are very good examples. For instance, Brazil has a financial transaction tax, maybe a small one, that ran very well for 15 years until the pressures from the financial sector obliged to put it down. But with that, they financed the expansion of the social protection system. In Mongolia, for instance, universal child benefit was paid with a very small tax on copper exports, on mineral exports. And that is, it was a universal child benefit, extremely useful for the population. And likewise, we have seen, you know, countries in Africa, and Latin America, using taxation of mineral exports. So this is an alternative. Second alternative will be to fight illicit financial flows. These are illegal, as we're saying, and this must be fought, like money laundering or like tax evasion, and this must be combated. Third option, very relevant for population, is to increase social protection, social security coverage by formalizing people in the informal sector with good contracts. And these good contracts will include also contributions to social security. And this is a way that many countries have extended social protection coverage, like Argentina, Brazil, Tunisia, and many others. Fourth, and this is very important in this moment, to restructure debt. And of course, we may want a cancellation of debt, but there is also the option of restructuring or renegotiating debt. And more than 60 countries have done so successfully in the last years. Another option will be to use to adopt more accommodative macroeconomic frameworks. That means some tolerance to inflation and fiscal deficits without leading to major macroeconomic imbalances, just a small tolerance. Then another option, 6, will be to tap into fiscal and foreign exchange reserves. And that sounds kind of odd, but let me give you an example. It's nothing complicated. Many countries have tons of reserves accumulated in the central bank. The rule of gold, the the general accepted rule is like it must be 4 months of exports in case there was some imbalance. But many countries that have food security problems in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, have much more accumulated in the central bank in reserves. It's simply this is a conservative policy that is not needed in places where development needs are large. You know, these reserves could be utilized to be invested in people. And then another option will be more aid and transfers for those countries that are low income. And finally, to reallocate public expenditures, for instance, from sectors that have very limited positive social positive impacts like defense to other sectors that will have large positive impacts. And you have very good examples here. For instance, Costa Rica or Thailand use military expenditures, defense expenditures to expand health coverage and make it universal. So just to say, these eight alternatives are fully endorsed by the United Nations and the international financial institutions. They exist in all countries. All countries will have a number of them available, and they must be discussed in public dialogue, including in parliamentarian dialogue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is terrific to hear the eight ideas, and thank you for making all the parliamentarians aware. And I think, as you say, this is an opportunity for them to bring in the population, make more people aware of some of the issues and options that exist and are being discussed, and to foster that kind of dialogue at the local level and at the national level so that there are more informed and supported decisions being made. We really appreciate that. Our next speaker is Senator Nancy de la Sierra Aranburo. She represents the state of Puebla, a beautiful state. She's the secretary of the presiding board of the Mexican Senate and also the special commission for the 2030 agenda, as well as the secretary of the Foreign Affairs Commission. And Senator Nancy, as we've been calling you Senator de la Sierra, over to you for about 5 minutes, please.
Gracias, distinguidos y distinguidas parlamentarios.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon. Hello from Mexico. It is a pleasure to be here. I salute Duarte Pacheco, president of the IPU. I also salute my colleagues, panelists, Mr. Pedro Arroyo Aguado and Madam Isabel Ortiz. I've been very interested by what they said, and I salute also my Mexican colleagues, among others, Alejandra Reynoso and Mr. Vasconcelos. Thank you to the IPU for inviting me to participate in this very important forum on sustainable development of the United Nations. It's an honor to represent Mexico and this, in this forum that congregates parliamentarians from all over the world. I am happy to be here also because today Mexico will present its third voluntary report as one of the countries that will report on the advances and compliance of the subject we are talking about. So in this last year and a half, we had to face the hugest challenge in the human history, COVID-19. It was also a health, a social and economic crisis that has no borders. In that sense, the government's role has been very important as the circumstances ask us for a further role in order to act against the pandemic impact. On one hand, at a national level, the governments had a very important role, which is taking care of the citizens' well-being and making the state work, still working. So the authorities became the representative of all the sectors, public and private, and they had to coordinate the responses at the federal and local level. They needed to design plans and programs of emerging policies in order to solve the family's problem. In my country, the great example is the vaccine deployment strategy. We wanted to reach every vulnerable population of the countries so they all have access to the vaccine. At the international level, we reached support responses and we shared good practices. So multilateralism and international cooperation were proven more important. So the United Nations were vital in order to reach a consensus and solutions. As it has been said, nobody is safe until we are all safe. In that sense, as one of the main lessons learned of during this pandemic, it was a reminder that the government need to offer everything needed to the human development to take care of the population, to the environment, and the progress. But we need to take into account that in order to do that, the government needs to work hand in hand with every sector in the society. There we find the parliamentary role as key. As a representative of the citizens, we are to improve the relationship between